Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
We will be having a presentation today by Dr. Reyes, and we're going to have time at the end of that to have questions. So just to dive in, not to take up too much time, I want to just go over where we are at when we're looking at, you know, how we're progressing with COVID-19 throughout the country. So this is a snapshot. These results were taken from Johns Hopkins this morning. And this really just demonstrates where we're at in the United States. Over 2 million cases with, unfortunately, over 116,000 deaths as of this morning. We do know that as we are seeing reopening, we're seeing some spikes. And if you go to the next slide, Shane, I wanted to share with you just the image that we really haven't shared in a while. And this is from the COVID-19 projections website. There is a link in our library to this website. And, you know, when we were in the first few weeks of this, we were seeing some trends and there was a lot of discussions about how do we flatten the curve. And we implemented throughout the country social distancing. And now that we're seeing those things lift, we are seeing some spikes. You may have seen it across, you know, in multiple headlines that states such as Texas, Arizona, Florida, we're seeing spikes. And there has been some recent headlines, and I'm not gonna steal Dr. Reyes' thunder, but we've seen recent headlines of as many as 16 people at one event becoming affected because of socializing without masks. You know, we are still awaiting data from what's happening with, as we see some protesters without masks. So, you know, there's a reasons to be concerned. If you go to the next slide, just so that we're all aware, this is where we're projecting for estimated infections. We are seeing every day higher numbers than what we were, I would say, just like 2 weeks ago. So there is some reasons to be alarmed. You know, there's a lot of discussions out there in the news about whether this is a second wave or a first wave. I'm gonna let Dr. Reyes unpack that as well as some recent news making studies and headlines. So with that, I'm gonna turn the floor over to Dr. Reyes. And Dr. Reyes, I would ask for you to introduce yourself to our audience. I believe most people know and appreciate what you've done for in FAMDA and AMDA. So I'm turning the floor over to you. Thank you.
Well, how are you, everybody? And thank you, Dr. Sanders, for the kind introduction. My name is Bernardo Reyes. I am an internist, a geriatrician. I currently work for Florida Atlantic University there. I run the inpatient geriatric service at Delray Medical Center with the associate medical director for one of our skilled nursing facilities where residents and students were rotating with us. And also I'm the associate program director for our internal medicine program. Hopefully I can keep you entertained for the next few minutes and we'll have time for questions. And I want to plug a couple of things. The first one is I want to, you know, thank you again, AMDA, for giving me the honor of presenting. And the second thing is nowadays that we pay so many fees for, and I promise you, Ian didn't ask me to say this, but for the last few months, you know, I've been renewing all my memberships and sometimes when you renew the membership, you look at what kind of value I can get from this. And definitely FAMDA has proven to be a high value tool. I think that these weekly meetings of the minds are proof that FAMDA is trying to fill the void that, you know, some of our government have left, and leading the discussion about what we need to do to protect our patients in these unprecedented times. So next slide. So our key learning points today, we're going to go through a little bit through the national state trends, although Dr. Sanders already talked about the national. Some of the nursing home data. We're going to talk a little bit about the testing, some updates, and then little mention about the three major things that happened in the literature in the past few weeks about therapy and the future opportunities. Next slide, please. So for everybody here in this audience, most likely this is not news. I mean, the trend towards is upward. The number of cases have skyrocketed. I was looking at the older versions of these same data that comes from the health department. And I was shocked that, you know, just a few weeks ago, we were talking about numbers and below the 500s every day. And suddenly, I mean, we're back to, you know, these back, not even, I mean, we are higher than ever before. And in terms of new cases per day. Next slide, please. And for the sake of the argument, because for some, and might be a valuable, you know, a valuable opinion, is that, you know, the results of all these upward trends are just because we're testing more. And these actually is something that I show to people, is that it's not only about the number of new cases, it's actually the percentage of new cases in every single day that the testing is reported. So if you look at this graph, you see it's difficult to deny that it's a trend upwards in the number of the percentage of new cases that occurred every day. Next number. And obviously following up with the same data, we can see that the bulk of the cases are occurring on the younger populations, so that there's nothing new there. And also the sad part obviously is that the death toll is provided by the patient population that we serve. As you can see in this table from the health department, 85% of the actual mortality in our state is from patients above the age of 65. And if you look at the last numbers on the right, you look at the absolute mortality in these patients per case, looking at almost a third of every single patient above the age of 85 dying from COVID-19 if they get the disease, if they get the infection. Next number. Also looking a little bit of CDC data, and this is also pertinent to Florida, you can see that the actual prevalence of COVID infections in skilled nursing facilities have stayed somehow flat. I believe that also is associated to the mortality rate and also the way that it is reported. Most of the facilities have to report if patients got COVID when they are in the facility or in another facility. The issues will be challenging to actually look at the positivity of COVID-19 patients when they get transferred to the hospital and they get discharged home. And perhaps the most shocking part of all this is if you look at the graph on the bottom, is that, you know, our staff is also being exposed to this disease disproportionately, I would say. I think it's the first time that I see this phenomenon where, you know, the people that supposed to care for these patients are equally exposed or even more exposed to the disease. Next one, please. Mortality wise, and this is something that we have to look carefully and not be too optimistic about it. But if you look at Florida, the mortality rate per 1,000 residents is around 11.9 per every 1,000 residents, which is considerably low. Where in terms of, you know, data per se, raw data, we're doing relatively good or very good, I would say. especially if you compare ourselves with, you know, other states where, like New York, Massachusetts, and Connecticut, where 50% of the mortality of all the state comes from nursing homes. Next one, please. So let's talk a little bit about challenges. And I'm going to go through some of the articles that I found in the literature that have come up to light in the past few weeks. And also I'm going to share with you some unpublished data. So let's start with, one of the main challenges is how we can identify who has a COVID infection. And again, the triad of cough, fever and malaise, and it's really not there for a lot of the patients that we treat. And I'm going to bring to the group this study that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine last week. And what the authors looked at the patient population or the patients that come out of the Diamond Princess cruise, for those for the few of you that were not aware about it, this Diamond Princess cruise was perhaps the flagship of the COVID-19 crisis in terms of the cruise ship industry, where the around 712 patients or persons became infected with COVID-19. The amazing, finding perhaps is that from all those 410 of the infected people were asymptomatic at the time of the testing. What the authors looked at is that they looked at the patient population, a subgroup of patients that were transferred to a hospital after they were disembarked from the cruise ship, and they follow them through for a period of 28 days. 11 out of those 96 people developed symptoms with a medium time to symptom onset of 4 days, and as far as 14 days. So the risk of being, the reason why I'm bringing this to the attention of the group is one of the findings of the authors was the risk of being pre-symptomatic or even asymptomatic was increased with age. I'm also want to bring to the attention of the group for those that didn't have the time to attend. There was an online global symposium last Sunday where we have experts from China, the United States, and Europe. One of the experts actually was our local Dr. Joseph Auslander, which we have the privilege to have here in our state. And I have the honor of working with him at FAU. So I'm going to bring one of the few of the points that I believe were worth sharing with the group at least. So the first one is, and this is, by the way, this is data that came from Genesis. And Genesis, as a group of investigators led by Dr. Vincent Moore from Brown University, to look at their trends and characteristics of the patients that were infected with COVID-19. One of the, so I'm gonna go through, again, a few of the things that were discussed during that presentation from Dr. Moore. The first one is that who is at risk? And apparently those residents that are in facilities with a high number of beds, Blacks, residents that are in facilities within cities that had high population density, and residents that are in facilities that have a high number of cases in the community. The other interesting subject that was discussed was the constants of the atypical presentations of symptoms, and how the triads that we are expecting to have in these patients occurred less often than what we would like to. They were looking at, and I will go through this at the end of these slides, but they were looking at how inconsistent the presentation of typical symptoms is in this patient population. One of the things that Dr. Moore was presented was the how temperature changes, how the temperature curve changes in the days prior to the diagnosis of COVID-19 infection in nursing home patients. And the surprising part, and again, I don't have his slides, and I wish I would, it's unpublished data at this point. You could see his graph. It's, what you can see is that the geriatric baseline, as he defined it, was this temperature around 98.2. And anything above that, if patients are above their baseline, that should be a reason for us to be concerned about the possibility of a COVID-19 infection. He also actually, and this is personal conclusion, I don't think that it was supported by evidence, is that perhaps looking at the CDC threshold of 100.4 for testing, it might be too high for the patient population that we serve. We all know that. I mean, I have to just be mindful that I'm trying to present data. So I'm trying to keep my personal opinions away from this. He also presented very interesting data on low O2 saturation. And that appears to happen frequently in few days before the patient becomes positive for a COVID infection. And also they stress the need of keeping in mind the concept of changing condition on any patient. Overall, and this is more like a personal editorial comment about his presentation, and is that that we have to be more aggressive, even in long-term care residents, about measuring O2 sats and temperatures on daily basis at the minimum. And again, I know there's a change in pattern, but these are unprecedented times that required unprecedented actions. Next. Another interesting thing that happened last week, the CDC came up with new recommendations updated recommendations for testing. Their recommendations were in three major areas. The first one is viral testing of healthcare workers. And they're recommending, obviously, initial testing for all. And this is not news to anybody. And they reinforce the need of weekly testing, but also they recognize that there have to be flexibility about these recommendations, this specific recommendation. For those that have not had the pleasure of having a nasopharyngeal swab, I can tell you in a personal note, it is one of the worst experiences you can have before you start working on Monday morning. So if you have personnel that has issues already being motivated to come to work on Monday mornings, all you need to do to definitely get rid of them is just offer this thing on a weekly basis. I mean, it's amazing how uncomfortable these tests is. Not to mention how challenging it's going to be to operationalize having this test done every single week in our healthcare workforce. You can imagine the cost and the need of staggering shifts in order to make this feasible. And also think about the validity of these tests when you have somebody that has been working all week in our facilities, and maybe on a Friday afternoon you want to test them even before they go home, before their shift on Monday or on Sunday, and then they get exposed when they're going to Publix or to any grocery store, and then the test just means nothing. And I understand the rationale of it, and I think all of us do. It's just the challenging part of it. The other area where they had recommendations was in viral testing of residents. They still recommend that each resident in a nursing home should be tested. They also recommend that in the event that somebody has respiratory conditions or respiratory illness, to consider testing these patients for other common things that we're accustomed to see, such as the flu. Flu season, as scary as it sounds, it's almost around the corner. So we have to start thinking about the possibility of some of these respiratory conditions not being associated with a COVID infection. And perhaps the other part that, and it's the most interesting part, is part of contact tracing. And they obviously leave that to our healthcare departments at the state and local levels. I will tell you, I have been trying to become more knowledgeable about the techniques used for contact tracing, and obviously our infectious disease or infectious prevention specialists in each one of our facilities needs to start becoming more and more familiar with contact tracing. But obviously it's a very challenging, time-consuming task. Again, I have been trying to become more proficient, and I can tell you it's not an easy task. The last area where they provided recommendations was in viral testing in response to an outbreak. And, you know, there is nothing new about it. It's just obviously perform expanded viral testing. And we are doing that anyway when we actually tested absolutely everybody in the facility. But, you know, that perhaps the most challenging portion of this recommendation is that they recommend that you keep testing every single resident every 7 days until no new cases are identified in the facility for at least a period of 14 days. And again, for those that had the pleasure of having a nasopharyngeal swab, I can see the challenges of trying to complete these tasks on a weekly basis, or even every 3 days if you want to be more aggressive, on patients with significant cognitive impairment. Again, it's very challenging recommendation, and hopefully we can do our best to deliver to the best of our capabilities. Next one. New England Journal of Medicine again, and this was one of the things perhaps that kept kept me awake the day that I read this, is the false negative rates of the current PCR test. And so the false negative rates reported for all these PCR tests available ranges from 2 to 29%. This is not that, you know, this is not only the concerning part. If you look at if you apply that low sensitivity to the wrong patient population, you're going to find yourself with a significant amount of false negative tests, because the pretest probability obviously will increase if you test the people that have had a high risk exposure or they have symptoms. The problem in our patient population is that because symptoms present atypically, you're less likely to identify the right people to test. Therefore, your pretest probability will be, you know, indeterminate at the best, and your post-test probability is going to be obviously low. So again, challenging times with tools that are not optimal. We still have to deliver the best care that we can. Next one. Infection control. And again, based on the prior slide from, especially the one at the beginning talking about symptoms, we have to have a very high index of suspicion and a low threshold for isolating for COVID-19. This is very challenging. I mean, most of our facilities will have share rooms and we have limited space, and sometimes when capacity, obviously, when we are at 80%, 85% of occupancy, you know, trying to achieve these, you know, isolation measures is challenging. We still need to operate under the assumption that that the available testing is inaccurate, and so therefore, even in patients that have negative testing, if we have a high level of suspicion that the patient might be infected with COVID-19, I think that the clinical your clinical judgment should be dictating the management. Now that you know a lot of people are talking and even you know strongly concerned and even doing you know opening facilities, our buildings to visitors outside. And again, another challenging task for us. You know, the argument that you know, especially this recent study that was published in Nature about the use of masks, and also the CDC last published recommendations. In terms of the, you know, the low risk of exposure in the outdoors. Now you could argue that you can have these family visits, you know, in the outdoor areas of our buildings. And again, it's something that for me, it's very challenging to see how we can operationalize this. I mean, how we can look at the kind of visitors that we're getting in terms of their risk of getting our residents infected or the opposite. Our friends from the north, they are going to be blessed with really good weather, and we are blessed too with amazing weather in our beautiful state pretty much all year long, but we are approaching the months where our weather is not precisely the most pleasant. So outdoor visits, it's going to be an interesting approach to these things. Think about services such as dining rooms. You know, when we're going to allow our residents to sit in the dining rooms again, because social isolation is a big problem in our facilities. And also physical therapy. This morning I was thinking about when I was preparing this slide actually, is how if we were looking at our MDS and see how the new needs for assistance for activities of daily living is going to trend. If you looked at it in the pre and post COVID era. And also adequacy how we're going to use our for some facilities limited space to keep the long-term residents perhaps away from the short-term patients that are coming from the hospital, and also how we're going to room these patients that are coming from the hospital even when they have COVID tests completed there that were negative. If we're assuming that at least a third of them could have the disease, you know, room sharing perhaps is a very...
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
And I think based on and I'm not an epidemiologist. I mean, I'm not trying to say something outside of my area of expertise, but now, I think there is the possibility that we're facing a second wave. When I was looking at data midst of May, you could be cautiously optimistic that we were actually going through a phase where we could be back to normal and if we would actually wait for a little bit longer. And again, I'm not trying to put a political stand on this presentation. This is not my place. But if you look carefully at the trends, it would look like that if we wait for a little bit longer, we will be in a different situation today than we were right now. And I think that for all of us in the post-acute industry, is trying to, as a group, trying to define our role in this pandemic. We have to be sure that we have enough representation sitting at the table where all these decisions are made. Obviously hospitals and government have be the drivers of the discussion, but we need to be more involved. I think that, at the end, 1.5 million people live within our buildings in this country. So we have to be sure that we looked at the best way for us to provide the care to them, but also to serve the community and protect the community that's around us. How will we to operate under the new normal? I mean, I think it's a challenge that everybody's thinking about. I mean, what this means to for the long term. Is the vaccine the solution to this? After we start vaccinating everybody, people are going to be less likely to die in our buildings. This issue of PPE and isolation is going to be resolved. I doubt. We know this because because of the flu. So is a deadly virus. It's something that we need to consider. What will be the long-term plan? How are we able to operate under this new normal for the long run? One of the things that were discussed in the symposium, the Chinese experts talk a lot about mental health, and not only for the residents, they highlighted the need of having appropriate mental health a number of healthcare providers in the post-acute setting, but also they talk about about staff. So how we're being affected at a personal level by this pandemic, and what kind of support we will need. And lastly, obviously, the sustainability of, the financial or logistic issues. And just to mention too, thinking about PPE for the long run and the availability of testing if we follow CDC recommendations. Next one. And for the business model, again, how we're going to survive through this is, and again, things to consider is the cost of testing, the forming the COVID units, PPE, the perception of the community. Again, I run an inpatient geriatric service and just 15 days ago, I had a 95-year-old patient that had a hip fracture that was living at home. And she stated that she preferred to die alone at home and maybe being able to see their children than actually being in a facility where she might get the virus, quote unquote. So we have to be sure, and the hospitals have been doing a great job about this, being sure that we're taking all the measures necessary to keep our buildings safe for our patients and for our residents. And the perception of our community partners too, it's what they think about us. Also looking at the resources available. I know the hospital where I work is offering PPE to the facilities where they referred the bulk of their patients, and also facilitating testing. It's also important that you don't look only at your state and local representatives in government, but also look at your community partners and see what they can offer. Next slide, please. And I think it's one of the things is this is part of what I part of my research portfolio and one of the areas where I have been concentrating since I work with Dr. Auslander is reduction of acute transfers. So I think this time has given us the opportunity to really look into these as a problem, as a challenge, that transferring patients acutely we don't have as much of the push from families and nurses saying this patient needs to go back to the emergency room, this patient needs to go back to the hospital. Patients and families are now, or residents and families are now more mindful that going to an emergency room might be more dangerous than trying to treat a changing condition in our buildings. So it's a great opportunity to improve, start the implementation of specific programs, structured programs, that can help us manage conditions within our buildings. AMDA has wonderful tools, and of course, Intrac is one of those tools that is available online at not cost. And also look at this an opportunity to work more with our community partners on value-based payment models. If I build this skill to treat changes in condition in my building, I will be able to participate in these value-based payment models where I get compensated for treating these patients within the building and not sending them back to the emergency room. Next one. Telemedicine, obviously, for everybody. We have been, now that payers are including Medicare, are more flexible in compensating or giving reimbursement for telemedicine-based services. We have been able to use the relationship with the community and the community partners to bring that necessary expertise to the buildings without exposing the provider or the patients. I think the other thing that telemedicine has given us is also is limit the provider exposure to high-risk patients or off high-risk patients, especially the office visits. And the silver lining of this is that we're not taking that 95-year-old patient with diabetes that has been controlled with a low-dose metformin and sometimes with diet to their every 6 months visit to the endocrinologist. I think that everybody can see that has been a benefit. And also better utilization of staff. So this is one thing too. Next one. So in terms of treatment, just three little things that happen in the literature. As everybody knows, remdesivir, proved to decrease the length of stay in patients that were admitted to hospitals with COVID-19 infection. That was a randomized controlled trial. The mortality benefit was not there, but if you look at the confidence interval, was really close to one. Is on the upper range of the confidence interval was 1.04. I think it's, again, there were just 1,000 patients, which is considerable. But I mean, perhaps we will be looking forward to see if there are any subsequent analysis of the same data. Obviously, I mean, our second option, it has been more politicized than anything else. You have seen this study, this randomized controlled trial published in the New England Journal of Medicine that shows that hydroxychloroquine does not provide any benefits in terms of mortality or infection or severity of the infection in patients that have been exposed to COVID. So this is also for prophylactic use and not even for treatment. So there is definitely, it appears to be that the role of hydroxychloroquine in these specific disease has been discarded. And lastly, dexamethasone, again, another study recently published. This one in the hospital setting right now, not precisely to, applies to us, but dexamethasone 6 milligrams have been proven to decrease mortality, not only in patients that are intubated, but also in patients that will require an oxygen. And perhaps in the future, the combination of remdesivir plus dexamethasone could be something that we could start using in our buildings. Next one. Again, the last opportunity that I'm going to talk about is advanced care planning. And I have to, I just copy and paste these slides from Dr. Auslander's slide deck from his presentation in the symposium last Sunday. I mean, the key points are always, when we talk to families, try to use as much data to strengthen our discussion about advanced care planning. So using tools like e-prognosis and trying to use you're trying to use appropriate language. And I'm going to be on the second bullet. I want to highlight that I'm ashamed that I didn't bring the polls into this. I think this is a great opportunity to use polls. As you know, FAMDA is the home of polls, and we should try to start using it. These are special circumstances that merit the use of tools like this one. And when you start your conversation, I mean, there are tools that are available. Those are the websites. And perhaps the last part is prepared, you know, to be prepared for these for patients and for residents to die in the facility. So having not only the skills, but the necessary medications to treat symptoms when they are in that phase. And next one. And with this, hopefully I kept everybody awake. I'm sorry, I think I went over my time. And hopefully we can open the floor still for questions.
And you actually refined, Dr. Reyes. We do have two questions that came in over the chat. The first is from Dr. Edwards, and his question is, what are your thoughts on physicians doing telemedicine visits? Is SNFs versus in-person visits?
I completely support that. I think it's and you know, we are, especially nursing home physicians, geriatricians. I want to speak, you know, when all these crises started, you know, I was starting this inpatient geriatric service, but you know, as a geriatrician, we are accustomed to physical exam. We're accustomed to human contact, to that give the patients that perception and that we care about them, and physical contact plays a major role. I'm obviously that part is being lost, especially in those patients that you don't have established relationship with. But I believe that for the safety of the patients and the providers, telemedicine should be used. And again, if you looked at one of my slides, it's just there's more prevalence of COVID infected cases among staff than among the residents. So it's not only protecting ourselves, it's also protecting the residents. So we go from facility to facility, bringing these viruses. I mean, we're doing a disservice to the people that we serve.
Thank you. I completely agree. We have another question from Dr. Eduardo Diaz. Any comments on hypercoagulable states in COVID-19 patients?
It's a great question from Dr. Diaz. I think it's, you know, we just follow the literature from the New England Journal of Medicine. I think it's for those patients, especially those that have higher D dimers, you could consider the use of anticoagulation. In the inpatient setting, that at least in my practice has become the standard. I can tell you that I feel comfortable actually using anticoagulation on patients that have high D dimers and are COVID and they're COVID positive. I have not seen any significant increase on the risk of bleeding. And again, the literature is very, very limited. But again, these are unprecedented times. We're doing unprecedented things.
Diane, this is Joel Sander. Can I just comment on that one?
Yes. Yeah.
Great job, Bernardo.
Thank
as
you.
As usual. Actually, the two questions. I think that our membership and physicians need to decide when an in-person visit is appropriate versus a telemedicine visit. I think there are certain circumstances you'd want to do an in-person visit. One of the things that Bernardo and I have been doing, working with point of care and looking in a great deal of detail about the daily nursing assessment that's done, And I think that that daily nursing assessment could help guide a nurse during a telemedicine visit with a physician, if you can actually see the nurse and help guide them using the point-click-care nursing advantage module. But I do think in-person visits are unnecessary, especially when you're worried about someone's abdomen. You can't evaluate the abdomen easily over the phone. The question about hypercoagulable states, I totally agree with Dr. Reyes said. We have a paper in press. It probably will be published in this week in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society. That is, obviously we can't do randomized controlled trials, but this is a very relatively robust retrospective study of a large number of patients in European nursing homes. Can't remember, it's somewhat, I think it's about 16 nursing homes. And it showed that among nursing home residents who were COVID positive, who were treated with anticoagulants versus not treated with anticoagulants, there was no difference in outcomes. So I think what Dr. Reyes says is exactly right. If you have a patient that you're suspecting, COVID positive patient that you're suspecting might have a hypercoagulable state, base anticoagulation on the standard. Don't change the standard. They have elevated D-dimer. So I totally agree with that. And after other people have a chance to ask questions, I wanted to make a comment about visitors. So but there's other questions, I think.
Thank you, Dr. Auslander. We did have another question that came through the chat about remote patient monitoring. I don't know, Dr. Reyes, if you have or if anyone on the call has considered using remote patient monitoring to help reduce staffing demands, conserve PPE, protect staff, and reduce acute transfers.
I mean, as long as you can use it in the patient population that we serve, and the other issue is that you can generate the data is how you process it and how you can make it, how it can get to the provider. So one of the advantages, and again, I work with Dr. Joe a lot in these things, and we're trying to create prediction models, and we're trying to, you know, work with companies in artificial intelligence. I mean, you can have all the data in the world, but if those data are not processed appropriately, and they don't make it to the right person at the right time, all you're just creating is just noise and extra work. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm all for technology. I mean, I just changed my watch for the last version of it so I can have EKG. I mean, I wear one of these fancy rings now that tell me if I'm sleeping well. So I believe in technology giving feedback, healthcare related feedback. It's just the issue is this is so much information that needs to be processed by somebody in a way that can be delivered to the right person at the right time to make decisions. Otherwise, I don't think it's going to be useful.
Yeah, just to add a little bit more color commentary, for the company that I work for, United Healthcare, we have rolled out a lot of digital tools, but operationalizing that in a nursing facility, it's not something that we have done yet. I don't know if on the Optum side they've looked at it, but most of those digital tools and remote monitoring services have really gone to impact those of our retiree population who are outpatient, living at home, independent. So I think you really have to look at the population we're serving, as Dr. Reyes said, and I would be very interested in learning more if anyone has any more information about what is being done around remote patient monitoring in the post-acute long-term care space. Just to move to the next comment, there was a comment about families and getting families connected with the residents during the pandemic. Dr. Reyes, do you have any comments, anecdotes, or like how you guys have been doing that for your patient population?
I think the only comment I have is that when I was in the acute setting recently, the amount of resistance that I encounter from families and from patients to be transferred to a post-acute facility when they really need it. I mean, and one of the fears they have, the two fears they have is, I will contract the COVID-19 in that facility, and I'm not going to be able to see anybody for weeks. And so those are the two things that actually, I want to add a comment on that to Dr. Joe. So for me, I mean, I think that this specific circumstance where I would allow that will be at the end of life. And for those that have been in these COVID units, and I have. That would be one thing that I would definitely stress out. That it's especially not only for the patients, Dr. Joe, it's only for the providers. I mean, it's a very, very psychologically stressful situation to hold somebody's hand and the person tells you, don't let me die alone. So it is a very, very, you know, difficult experience to have in life. And when you have it several times a day, it's just, you know, so I think a family should be in.
Thanks for adding that. That is within the CMS guidelines, and we do that. In fact, when I was on teaching rounds last Thursday, I walked into a room to check on a person who was on hospice comfort care, and she had passed away literally within the last 10 minutes. 95 years old. Her husband was there, and the palliative care physician and nurse were there. So I totally agree with that. I was talking about non-end-of-life situations. Thanks for clarifying.
So I want to, and I thank you both. That was a great discussion and very, very important and subject that we have to be sensitive to in dealing with our residents who are at the end of life. I mean, you know, I really applaud you. I think that answered that comment about how to deal with families. We have one other comment that we're going to take. It is from Dr. Diaz. I don't know, Dr. Reyes, if you can see it in the chat.
So it's really, you know, it's just really quick, Eddie. I have no. For me, the number of cases being related to the amount of testing is a valid argument. The part where the counter argument to this is that the percentage of new cases is going up, and it's a trend upwards that nobody can deny. And this morning on the slide that I put
support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post Acute Care.
So you're talking about 10%, 1 in 10 of every single test that was done in the state came positive for a new case. So I mean, those are data that are difficult to. I understand that these are uncharted territories. It's difficult to know what this means long term. I can tell you that only that the trend is just the trend is there, and it's not only about the absolute number of cases, but also what proportion of those tests are positive to. That will be my take on it, and I agree with you that the media is trying to understand the difference between what the media says and what the scientific community says is difficult, and the media has taken a very invasive role, I believe, in this, you know, within all this situation.
Do we have, you know, I don't even know how to, when it comes to the media and what they are, what is being shared in the media versus what we're seeing, I would just implore everybody to just stay tightly adhered to what you're seeing coming out of the journal publications. FAMDA has an active COVID-19 library. AMDA has updates that are coming out. AGS has updates that are coming out. every day. We do have patients and staffs in the nursing homes who are asking us questions as the medical experts. So, you know, when we are looking at the scientific community, we're part of that. And I know there has been a lot of politics added on to this condition, unfortunately. So we really need to make sure that the information, whatever we're sharing and looking at and receiving, is the most unbiased information that we can get at that time, you know, even though that's difficult. And that's just a private question. In answering a very private question that came through the chat, you know, I wanted to just tackle that. I do thank you, Dr. Reyes, and for this wonderful presentation. I think it's a timely overview that we needed to take, given everything that's happening. I thank you all for joining this call. I hope to see you next week when we talk about, when we have a panel discussion on COVID-19 in the trenches. And thank you for joining this. If you missed any part, it was recorded and it will be available shortly, and a handout will be available on our website as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody.